morning, everyone, and welcome to another edition of TBS EFM's Inside Out. I'm your host, Walter Foreman. We've seen a growing number of United Nations offices in Korea in recent years, and one in particular that has been gaining attention is the United Nations Economic and Social Commission for Asia and the Pacific, or UNSCAP as it's better known. Its East and Northeast Asia office is located in Incheon, and today we've invited its director to tell us more about it. Dr. Kilapati Ramakrishna is an internationally known climate policy leader and environmental lawyer and has been in office since 2011. He will tell us what UNSCAP does and what his job is as the director of its sub-regional office for East and Northeast Asia. Stay tuned for that and a lot more coming up next. Good morning. You are listening to Inside Out. I'm your host, Walter Foreman. We are joined by our guest this morning, Dr. Ramakrishna. Thanks for joining us this morning, Doctor.
Delighted to be here, Walter. Thank you for having me on the program.
Well, it is our pleasure, and in the coming almost an hour that we have, I know we're going to talk about a lot of things, about what you do and about what you have done. Let's start with where you are these days, and I understand that you've been there since 2011. Of course, I'm talking about UNSCAP. Can you tell us more about that organization, its history, its objectives, its vision, and even its members?
I'd be delighted to, but let me first off say what a pleasure it is to have a radio station like the TBS EFM, particularly as a foreigner coming into this country. I was really looking for a place that gives me news and views of what's happening in the country and outside. And it's been a real pleasure to have the station and to be able to listen to it. And I want to thank you and the TBS EFM. Now, you asked me about UNSCAP and what it does what I do. The timing of this show and the invitation for me to be here is most appropriate because it is exactly about 60 years ago that Republic of Korea joined UNSCAP. So this is the year to commemorate the 60th anniversary. And United Nations Economic and Social Commission for Asia and the Pacific, of course, is the most comprehensive, inclusive, intergovernmental mechanism for all of the member countries of Asia and the Pacific. We range from Turkey and Iran on one side to Russia on the other with a number of Pacific Island countries. We number a total of 62, 53 members and 9 associate members. We were established in 1947, you know, one of the oldest regional commissions in the UN system. We were established originally in Shanghai. But we moved to Bangkok, where our headquarters is now, in 1949, and we have been there ever since. When it was established in 1947, it was called Economic Commission for Asia and the Far East. It is only in 1974 the name changed to Economic Commission for Economic and Social Commission for Asia and the Pacific. And I think there is an interesting story there. When the commission was established, there were 10 members. And amongst the 10, only 5 of them are geographically part of the Asia-Pacific. It's because of the colonization that was there at the time.
Right.
And a number of countries were, you know, colonized by the industrialized countries in Europe and elsewhere. And so now, with decolonization, the membership grew, and we have 62 member countries.
Well, Doctor, you've certainly given us a very thorough background of the organization, and what I noticed that was quite interesting, although you said the organization was founded in 47, and it's been 60 years that Korea has joined. So Korea joined I guess we could say relatively early in the organization's history, 5-6 years after I guess it started. Also interesting to note the move from Shanghai to Bangkok in 94 and its membership now, 62 members. And I guess that's maybe where my next question will take us. Talking about those 62 members, I mean, when we look at the name of the organization, UNSCAP, it has right in the name economic and social. So I'd like to know then, how does UNSCAP help its member countries develop both economically and socially?
The United Nations, let me just, for the benefit of our listeners,
of
say a little bit more about UNSCAP.
Mm-hmm.
There are two parts to it. One is the commission, and second is the secretariat. The commission is entirely comprised of the member countries.
Uh-huh, sure.
The secretariat is a secretariat established by the Secretary General of the United Nations,
uh-huh.
Appointed by the Secretary General of the United Nations. So what we do, what I do, and what the secretariat does is provide material as a think tank, an organ that is providing evidence-based policy recommendations to the member countries. But it is the member countries that decide what it is that they want the
mm-hmm.
secretariat to do,
yep.
where they need particular assistance, where they need help. So our job is really not to tell member countries what they should do, but to provide them with a state of play, you know, in terms of economic development, social development, or environmental protection, what it is that is happening to the country and
sure.
what they might do, and then give them the choice.
Sure.
If you want us to do, help you with this,
mm-hmm.
this is what we can do, and this
I
is
see.
What the implications of that are. So it is member-driven.
Yeah.
We are very much like the United Nations in the Asia-Pacific. The Commission is very much like the General Assembly in New York,
mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
where the member countries come every year
sure.
and then talk about issues that matter to them and
right.
then tell us what they would like us to do for them.
Well, it's a very important distinction that you make, Doctor, and I thank you for making it. And when you mentioned that the Secretariat of UNSCAP is indeed appointed by the Secretary General of the United Nations, I'm sure many of our listeners, or at least I hope many of our listeners, would be well aware of the Secretary General of the United Nations. Of course, that's Mr. Ban Ki-moon, very own person from here in Korea. So now that we sort of had a better idea that UNSCAP is indeed member-driven, could you then maybe give us some ideas of some of the things that UNSCAP has done for its members?
Right. Ever since the commission, regional commission, was established, ESCAP has been producing economic and social survey for Asia and the Pacific.
Uh-huh.
This is our one of the foundational documents that surveys the state of affairs on these important matters for Asia and the Pacific, and it has been continuously in production since 1947.
Right.
It makes at each time various policy recommendations on what the member countries might do. It tells, given what they are doing today, what the growth rate is likely to be, and
uh-huh.
What they might do, for improving the well-being of the people, you know, in terms of the social issues, whether it is aging, youth, gender equality, you name it, disabilities, and all of them. It is really, that's one major
sure.
document that we produce,
uh-huh.
but we also produce a theme study each year, which becomes current topic of that particular year, and the member countries then, on the basis of the recommendations, decide what they might want the secretariat to do.
Right. Well, it does sound like important work indeed, and I'm sure with 62 members, there's been a lot of work that has been going on there, and of course, with the long history dating back all the way to 47, again, I'm sure there's been a lot of important work done. I'm going to change the line of questioning here just slightly. If you are just joining us this morning, our guest is Dr. Ramakrishna. He's the director of the United Nations Economic and Social Commission for Asia and the Pacific's East and Northeast Asia office. And that's sort of where the question will lead us to next, Doctor. when we talk about UNSCAP opening up here in Korea, and then in particular in Incheon, I wonder if you could give us any background on that. More specifically, why Korea? And then a little bit deeper, why Incheon?
Right. A very good question, Walter, and I'm glad to talk about that. Let me start with why the regional commissions in the first place. You know, we have the UN Secretariat in New York. But as you know, when the UN was established, there were only about 51 member countries.
Right.
Now we have 193 member countries. And when the regional commission was established, as I said a while ago, there were 10 member countries, though only five of them are geographically part of Asia-Pacific.
Right.
But the membership increased. Now we have 62 member countries in Asia-Pacific. And so the General Assembly decided that efficient as it may be, it is difficult for Bangkok to deal with all the 62 member countries from Bangkok.
So
they wanted to establish sub-regional offices. And the decision was taken in December 2008. And by 2009, as is customary with the UN offices, a letter was circulated to all the six member countries. And I cover six member countries from this office, South Korea, North Korea, Mongolia, China, Japan, and Russia.
Okay.
And I also deal with two associate members, Macau and Hong Kong. So the letter was sent to six member countries and asking if any of them would be interested in hosting this office.
I see.
And Japan, China, and Korea expressed interest. Japan dropped out very early on, and China and Korea stayed until the end, and China dropped out in favor of South Korea at the end, then a decision by the commission was taken to establish that in Republic of Korea. Once a decision is taken, then where that should be located is left to the member country. And so what the procedure in this country is, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs then sends out this possibility to all the metropolitan cities in the country, and then they make their offers. And the offer that Incheon made was the one that the Republic of Korea liked, and they offered it to us, and then we accepted the same thing. And that is how it ended up being in Incheon. But the question, of course, is a broader one, you know, because it's not just my office being there, there are a number of other offices in Incheon. But it's not that, you know, as I said, there is a certain amount of laissez-faire system, you know, open it up for all the, you know, cities in the country and let them make offers, and then depending on whichever comes first. That, so there are a number of offices in Seoul, and there are a number of offices in Busan, and so on.
And it does seem, and I don't know if it's by coincidence or by design, but it does seem that lately, there have been more and more offices opening up in Incheon, and particularly in the Songdo region, and perhaps that has been by design, I guess, on the part of the on the Korean government, because it's interesting to hear how more or less it's just opened up to offers of which country wants to host these various offices, and then, of course, once that decision is made, then it's up to the choice of that country. And I guess that seems to be a very, very fair, very equitable system. And just to double check, Doctor, this was in 2008, was it, that the idea was first laid to have an office, a regional sub-office?
The decision by the General Assembly was taken in December 2008.
Okay, yeah.
And so it takes some time.
Of course.
And then so we opened our doors in May 2010.
May 2010, and you've been there since 2011, as we mentioned in the introduction. So you've been there not quite from day one, but certainly the majority of the time that the office has been open. And I'm sure there's a lot of stories that you can recount, and we'll do that. We'll get those stories from you, Doctor, on the other side of a short break. Don't go away. We'll be back with more of our conversation here today on TBS EFM's Inside Out.
Are you enjoying the program so far? If you want to listen again to the show, you can use the smartphone application iblog.com and search Inside Out or visit insideout.iblog.com. For more information about each week's program, visit our TBS EFM website, tbsefm.seoul.kr.
Good morning. You're listening to Inside Out on TBS EFM. I'm your host, Walter Foreman. Our guest this morning, Dr. Kilapati Ramakrishna, Director of UNSCAP. Well, just before that very short break, Doctor, we were talking about the background of the organization, the background of the Incheon office, excuse me. Now I'd like to talk a little bit, if we could, sir, about you. We mentioned in the introduction you were trained as an international lawyer, and I understand that your specialty is with the environment. I'm wondering then, given that, how did it come to be that you joined UNSCAP as its director?
Wonderful. I mean, I'm always pleased to talk about that because
glad to hear it.
it's a question that I get asked a good deal.
Sure.
Before I joined the United Nations, I was working at a think tank and also teaching law in a number of different universities. And the approach that I had was always about the work that I do and the policy implications of that.
Mm-hmm.
To give you just a very quick example, the first place I worked in Massachusetts was at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution.
All right.
It's a premier oceanographic research institution in the world. This is the institute that discovered the Titanic and Bismarck and various other things. And,
yes.
But that institute had a number of world-class oceanographers. But the president of that institute felt that their research should be in the policy realm, not by serendipity,
mm-hmm.
but by a conscious intervention.
Yeah.
And so they created a policy center, and I got to work there. And so the idea then was to take the research findings of the scientific community and say what the policy implications are. The
mm-hmm.
Law of the Sea Convention, as you may know, came largely because of the discovery of the manganese nodules in the sea.
Okay.
And if there is no regime on how those nodules are to be apportioned amongst the member countries, countries that have the technology can go and scoop up all of them,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and there will be nothing left for the other
right,
countries.
Right,
and
right.
So that kind of a policy matter is brought to the policy community quickly, and you know, so I was working on those kinds of issues. And even as a teacher, you know, whether I was teaching international law, law of international organizations, or environmental law, I was constantly thinking about what do we know as a scholarly community and what are the implications of that in the policy making. And I was constantly looking at the United Nations.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And so when the opportunity came to work for the United Nations Environment Program, I took it
mm-hmm.
because I was working almost all the time as an outsider looking in, can be done by
right.
the United Nations.
Right.
And so when I had this opportunity to join UNEP, I took that immediately and been working on that. You know, I worked there for 5 years, and then I said, well, that's enough. I should go back to my academic life
okay.
and research and teaching.
Sure.
But then, you know, this opportunity came,
mm-hmm.
so I came to work in this office.
Right, here in Incheon in Korea.
Right.
And presumably, was that your first time then to be, I guess, in Korea? Maybe you'd been here for conferences or other smaller things, but your first time, I guess, to live here then, was it?
Absolutely. I've been in Korea many times before.
I would imagine.
The thing, but then as a family, to come here with my wife and son, that was the first time.
Mm. And I'll point out for the benefit of the listeners that Dr. Ramakrishna has indeed brought his wife and his son to the studio with us this morning, so it's a pleasure to have them here as well. Give them a quick wave. And I guess I'd like to ask you then, Doctor, during the 3 years or so that you have been in Korea, particularly as the director here of UNSCAP and its East and Northeast Asia sub-office, could you tell us any sort of memorable projects or special events that have stood out for you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Korea is a very special country, and thank you for that warm welcome to my family.
My pleasure.
And, you know, let me start. You know, I have a daughter as well, but she's in graduate school in the United States. The three of us encounter essentially three different aspects of life in Korea.
Okay.
You know, as head of the United Nations office and ESCAP and ENEA, I do more things with the diplomatic community, with ministries of foreign affairs and other ministries, and the rest of the, you know, people in the sub-region.
Yeah, of course.
But my wife, you know, she's a special educator.
Okay.
You know, she has master's in special needs, you know, working with people with special needs. And she is volunteering in Talk House,
oh,
a wonderful initiative by the Incheon city, to help people talk in English language. And then they then get to volunteer and then help the community in very many ways. She's also chairperson of the Welfare Committee of Seoul International Women's Association.
Oh, I see. Yeah, sure.
So in that capacity, she looks at Korea from a quite a different perspective than what I do.
Absolutely.
And, of course, our son goes to, you know, went to Seoul Foreign School, and then, of course, he comes home with stories from his own
vignette.
So we enjoy Korea from all these various aspects, and so there is so much to learn about this country. It's
right.
a very small country, but there are so many aspects to it. And so though we have been here by some standards a long time, I still feel that there is so much more to learn and enjoy about the country and take those experiences to other countries that wish to emulate the example of Republic of Korea.
Well, there's two, and thank you as well, Doctor, for mentioning that you do indeed also have a daughter, but that she's not with us today, and we wish her well in her studies, graduate studies, as you mentioned, in the U.S. And two things that I take away from your response there, and I'll certainly agree with, are that Korea is a place that you can get to know quickly, but once you get to know it, there's quickly a lot more that you discover can be learned, and I'm glad to hear that you're wanting to take the time to do that. And the other thing is, of course, that you have this experience of being living in many other cities and countries around the world, and it's nice to hear how sort of that compares to Korea and how that you and your family indeed are experiencing Korea in different ways. And it's going to be fascinating to hear a lot more about that, particularly in the way that you experience Korea and the things that you do, and of course that your organization does, and that of course is the UNSCAP, the United Nations Economic and Social Commission for Asia and the Pacific, and you are of course the director of the East and Northeast Asia office. We'll be back with more in our conversation today here on TBS EFM's Inside Out after this break.
How are you enjoying the program so far? If you want to listen again to the show, you can use the smartphone application iblog.com and search Inside Out or visit insideout.iblog.com. For more information about each week's program, visit our TBS EFM website, tbsefm.seoul.kr. Number one foreign language station. Coming to you from the heart of Seoul. 101.3 TBS EFM.
Good morning. Our guest this morning here on Inside Out is Dr. Kilapathy Ramakrishna. Welcome back to the program, Doctor.
Thank you.
Well, in the first half of our conversation, I think we got a lot of good foundational information about the UNSCAP, where you are the director of the East and Northeast Asian sub-office here in Incheon. We got also some background into your life and that of your family. It's been interesting. Now I'd like to turn it back, if I could, Doctor, to UNSCAP itself, particularly something that you did touch on in the first part of our conversation I'd like to get into a little bit deeper, and that is what's called the organization's maybe flagship publication, the Annual Economic and Social Survey of Asia and the Pacific. Could you give us a little more detail about what that report is and its significance?
So thank you, Walter. This is, as I said, our oldest and the most comprehensive annual review of economic and social development in Asia and the Pacific. It's been published continuously since 1947, and the aim is to provide our member countries with up-to-date and in-depth analysis of current trends and emerging challenges in the region. The goal is to contribute to making policy on the basis of the evidence that is supplied in this survey. Just to give you an example,
sure.
Despite Asia-Pacific's dynamism and fast economic development during the past few decades, oftentimes called the Asian century, there is a growing development gap between countries and also within countries, with large pockets of poverty and underdevelopment. How do we facilitate the movement of goods and people that help bridge the development gap by allowing better access and diffusion of the benefits of the economic growth is a key priority of our organization, and we work with member countries on that, and this annual survey is a key tool in helping us get to that point.
Sure. Undoubtedly, and again, interesting to hear that the report, the publication, this annual report has been produced every year since 1947. I can only imagine the changes that have occurred over that time, not only in the findings of the report, but even perhaps in the way that the report is produced. And that's actually what I'd like to focus on next, Doctor. Can you give us some insight into how a report like that is really put together? Because, I mean, it must be challenging to bring in all the sort of areas that need to be focused on into one report.
Right. You know, it is a very complex exercise.
Sure.
There are my colleagues who work on the data crunching, but then the data itself is compiled from various sources. These include information that is available from government sources to international organizations, whether it is World Bank or the Asian Development Bank or the International Monetary Fund, and of course a large number of research institutes and think tanks in Asia and the Pacific. That is the basic core material, and so we take that and then say, well, what are the trends? What is the likely economic growth in the region, in various pockets of the region, and what are the implications of that, for people and the aspirations of the nations, as they oftentimes announce at the time of the elections or at the time of budgets and so on.
Sure.
What is the match?
Yeah.
You know, are you likely to get to where you think you would like to take your country? Those kinds of issues are addressed.
Well, absolutely. Very important then to help those countries, those regions, and those areas to, I think, both know what is happening, to have this concrete data to know what's happening, and then also to know what needs to happen next. I'd like to maybe pick up on that a little bit if we could. You mentioned that it looks at trends and it looks at challenges in regions. You mentioned perhaps as one challenge the development and income gaps between countries and within countries. Is that sort of the main sort of issue that's coming out of these most recent reports, or can you also let us know about maybe some of the other challenges that are coming from the report?
Right. Of course, we are now at a very exciting time, one of the most difficult times, however you want to call it. I say exciting time because the agenda that the United Nations is trying to address in 1 year is almost breathtaking.
Mm.
If you take 2015 as an example, we're just a few days from 2015,
yes.
We begin the year in March with the Hyogo framework in, this is for disaster risk reduction, mega conference in Japan.
Okay.
And then we move on to the post 2015 development agenda.
Yes.
The Millennium Development Goals adopted in 2000 are coming to an end in 2015.
That's right.
And we need to come up with the next steps, you know, whether they are sustainable development goals or whatever. And then we have the climate summit taking place in December in Paris. And this is extraordinarily important because there is no other topic that encompasses every aspect of life and influences and impacts every aspect of life like climate change.
Right.
And so that meeting is very important. And as you know, in Incheon, we have the Green Climate Fund in the same building that, where I work. In addition to all of those things, the 70th anniversary of the United Nations is also 2015, because it came into existence in 1945.
Yes.
So when you think about all this, it is a great opportunity to make big progress by showing the interconnections that exist. So but what we try to do in UNSCAP and East and Northeast Asia office is really to bring that global agenda to the region, to the sub-region,
right,
and to engage countries in terms of making the connection in terms of the priorities that they identify and the priorities that the United Nations has identified, and say that they are not really different from one another, and working on one contributes to the other. And we need to make those connections and then make sure that everybody understands and then show enthusiasm.
Mm.
It's very easy to be dispirited when you're confronted with a challenge like this.
Yes.
And so we need to make sure that that is not the case.
Mm.
And then keep a level of optimism and say that it can be done and we move forward in that direction.
Well, you know, in the old classic, very, very rudimentary psychology test of the glass is either half full or half empty if you're an optimist or a pessimist.
Right.
I think, and please forgive me if I'm wrong, and correct me even if I'm wrong, but it would seem that you, sir, then are an optimist. As you said, it is an exciting time rather than a difficult time, but certainly it could be looked at as a difficult time. Glad to hear you framing it as exciting, and certainly I hope I speak for everyone here that we wish you the best of luck in achieving all of those things that need to be done in the coming year. It certainly will be a busy one indeed. Now, coming back maybe to one of the issues that had come out of the Economic and Social Survey of Asia and the Pacific, focused particularly now on Korea, and it's a topic that gets a lot of attention in Korea, that's the economy. As I understand it, and I have to be, of course, perfectly honest, I couldn't read the entire report, but looking at pieces of it, and our writers also looking at some of it, it was reported that the Korean economy was expected to expand roughly around 4% this year. Can you give us any insight into how that number maybe is determined, and what were some of the main factors that could either help or hinder that type of growth in Korea?
Right. I'd be happy to, Walter. As I mentioned before, we take the data that is available to us from a number of sources. In Korea, you have some preeminent think tanks, Korea Development Institute and the KIEP and so on. So we draw material from them, and then when the survey came out, we expected the economy to show a very strong recovery. And the 4% that you said is, you know, is what was mentioned there.
Yeah.
But at the moment, we are forecasting around 3.5% GDP growth.
Yeah.
And it's because the recovery in private consumption following the ferry accident has been slow, weaker than expected, and the stimulus offered by the government is affected by less favorable internal and external conditions, whether it is monetary easing by the United States or further, you know, monetary easing in Japan. So these risks, the downside is that the high levels of household debt and slow growth of employment and wages from private consumption side.
Yeah.
So all of them are contributing to a slightly lower than expected growth of, you know, so we expect it to be about 3.5%.
And interesting that you mentioned less than favorable internal and external factors, giving us some examples of the external factors. I won't put you on the spot, sir, to ask for the less than favorable internal factors, but it'd be interesting to hear what those were. Perhaps that's a discussion for another time. Keeping the focus on Korea and particularly its economy, you know, often in Korea, when we hear these numbers, 3.5%, 4%, A lot of people on the outside are envious of that. You know, countries particularly thinking, well, that's pretty good growth in this day and age. A lot of people in Korea are saying, well, the sky is falling because they're used to the double-digit growth that was so prevalent through the late 90s and early 2000s, and of course, even before that. What I'd like to ask you, sir, is how does the Korean economy then affect the sort of economic dynamics in the entire region?
Well, I mean, Korea is... there are a number of different answers to the question.
One, of course, is
Korea as an example is literally the envy of developing countries, not just in Asia-Pacific, but all over the world. It's not only the envy of developing countries, but there are a number of industrialized countries that also, you know, want to see what's happening, right? Because Korea seemed to have gotten its act together, at least from an outsider's point of view. You know, there are, of course, differences within the country. You know, in terms of the social equity questions, you know, protections to small and medium-scale enterprises and, you know, a whole range of issues. So the first part, of course, is though Koreans might feel that this is not impressive growth, outsiders feel, as you pointed out correctly, that it's pretty good. So the question from the outsider's point of view is, what is it that Korea is getting right? And why is it we can't replicate, you know, that need to be done?
Right.
And the second, of course, is the growth, as I pointed out earlier, lower as it is, you know, what is the implication of that for the rest of Asia-Pacific? You know, the first part, you know, can be answered by a thoughtful and visionary leadership in the country right from the get-go, the desire to make change and the determination to work hard and not be daunted by the challenges, you know, that are there in front of you. You know, the work ethic is phenomenal, and, you know, particularly working in an office in Korea and to have many Korean staff members, I notice that almost on a daily basis. So that progress is, you know, impressive as is. But talking of this slower growth, etc., this has an implication for all of Asia-Pacific because Korea plays an extraordinarily important role in the Asian supply chain. You know, so Korea, out of total trade, you know, non-fuel, is more than 50% of exports and more than 70% of imports are of intermediate gold goods. This is part of the supply chain story. Also, Korea is providing an increasing amount of resources in the name of the development cooperation. And so if there is a downside here, that is going to affect, of course, you know, what Korea is able to do, you know, to Asia-Pacific and to the rest of the world.
Well, it's good to hear how important Korea is in the region, and it's good to hear also that, again, the forecasts that we're hearing, although they sometimes are not looked upon favorably here in Korea, it's good to hear sort of reinforced that indeed they are good forecasts. We're going to take another short break here, Doctor, but we'll be back with more in our conversation. Don't go away. This is TBS EFM's Inside Out.
Are you enjoying the program so far? If you want to listen again to the show, you can use the smartphone application iblog.com and search Inside Out or visit insideout.iblog.com. For more information about each week's program, visit our TBS EFM website, tbsefm.seoul.kr.
You're listening to TBS EFM's Inside Out. I'm your host, Walter Foreman. Our guest this morning, Dr. Kilapati Ramakrishna, Director of the United Nations Economic and Social Commission for Asia and the Pacific's East and Northeast Asia office located in Incheon. Doctor, I'd like to ask you what may be a challenging question, although I think there have been a couple of challenging questions already. You mentioned the countries that you oversee from the office there, the East and Northeast Asia office. One of those countries is indeed North Korea. It is part of the six member states of UNSCAP in the East and Northeast Asia region. What I'd like to ask you, sir, how does UNSCAP bridge North Korea then with, if indeed it does, with the rest of the member countries?
It is a very important question, Walter, and I'm glad that you asked, because North Korea, or as we call in the United Nations, the DPRK, Democratic People's Republic of Korea, is not a member of any of the regional groups that we have, whether it is APEC or East Asia Summit or any of those things. But it is a member of UNSCAP.
It is, yes.
And what is more, in my capacity as director of the East and Northeast Asia office, I'm also tasked with providing secretariat services to a separate intergovernmental body called NEASPEC, Northeast Asian Subregional Program for Environmental Cooperation. DPRK, while not a member of any of the other subregional programs or regional programs, is a member of not only UNSCAP, and as a result of that part of my subregion, but also a member of NEASPEC.
Right.
And so we work with the DPRK on both these issues, and it provides, we provide a unique opportunity for DPRK to learn and engage in regional dialogue and cooperation. And what pleases me is that even when the political tensions are very high, when we have the meeting, we have the DPRK at the table.
Right.
And we have, you know, ROK, Japan, working with DPRK in solving what they see as the common problem. And so it is very important. And so we provide probably the only window, if not the major window, for DPRK's participation in regional and multilateral dialogue and cooperation. And over the past 10 years, we have offered a lot of technical assistance to DPRK on a number of areas, whether it is energy, environment, trade, statistics, transport, etc. And in fact, we're going to have another meeting with them in March on joint ventures, and we just concluded a major mission to DPRK where we have identified a region that should be part of the Ramsar Convention
for wetlands. For wetlands,
exactly. And so, you know, so yes, we do that. And we do that by not focusing on the politics.
Of course.
You know, we stay with economic matters, social matters, and environmental matters.
Well, it does sound then as though UNSCAP in this, and in many ways, of course, but particularly as it relates to our neighbors to the north, the DPRK, it does sound though as though UNSCAP is providing a very valuable sort of bridge there, allowing the DPRK to receive the transfers that you talked about in terms of technology and joint ventures coming up in the next year. And so it is, I think, a very positive sign. And again, that's something that we talked about earlier, looking on the positive side of things. It does seem to be a positive interaction then. Am I right in using that word, the relations then, when DPRK does come to the table, is it generally a positive contribution that they're bringing?
Absolutely. In fact, in my experience, I have not seen any kind of controversy. The controversy that you see is them not saying anything. But when they do say, you know, they identify what areas they need help and ask for that help. And, you know, we also have other channels of communication through their diplomatic missions in Bangkok and in other places. And we talk to them about what they need and how we can help them move forward with those
issues. Good to hear. Yeah, very, very good to hear. And as I said, Doctor, perhaps a challenging question. I'll try to make up for that now with maybe a somewhat easier question, coming back to talking a little bit about yourself. Now, you've worked for a few years in many capacities with the United Nations. Something that you alluded to earlier was the UN Environment Program, rather, UNEP. You were a principal policy advisor there. Can you tell us, I guess, what's it like to work for the UN, and have you worked in other capacities for the United Nations?
Yes, I started by being a special advisor to the International Negotiating Committee for the Framework Convention on Climate Change, and had a major role in drafting the Framework Convention, and I also worked on Kyoto Protocol, but those are unique to my particular training as an international lawyer in drafting and interpretation and facilitating countries to come together and do that. But with UNEP, of course, it is the voice of the United Nations on environment. It has the ability to use its bully pulpit and say what the world should be doing on environmental protection. And so it was very exciting to be part of that. And we began the effort to convert UNEP from the group of 53 countries as part of the Governing Council into making a UN Environment Assembly, you know, where all the 193 member countries come together. So it's very exciting. But that is only part of the current agenda. You know, we're now talking about sustainable development goals.
Yes.
We're talking about integration of the economic pillar, social pillar, with a very healthy dose of governance, you know, overlaying across all of those three things. And so, while I was very delighted to be part of UNEP and have done the work that I did for 5 years, what we are trying to do now really cuts across different, you know, key pillars, you know, for sustainable development, and that's what I'm working on now.
Well, we had a guest a few weeks ago, actually, on the program talking about sustainable development and social development. So we know how important that is indeed. I'd maybe like to expand just a little bit, to pull back just a little bit, Doctor. I know when I meet young people, of course, we know in Korea that the youth unemployment is particularly high. But when you ask people what they want to do, many of them say that they do want to work for the United Nations, and perhaps that's the influence of Secretary General Ban. If you then, having worked for the United Nations and having got into the United Nations from as you said yourself, working on the outside, could you offer any advice maybe to young people who are looking to work for the United Nations? What's something that really could help set them apart, or at least help them to get on the path to working for the UN?
Thank you for that question, Walter, because I do get asked that question a great deal by people that come to our office and are when I go to give lectures in various universities. And I think you're absolutely right. Secretary General Ban is extremely popular in the country. And, you know, when I go to speak at various places, I'm almost seen as the closest thing to Secretary General Ban for them to come and shake hands with me.
Very nice.
And I feel really wonderful about that.
You know,
there's no question about it. The second thing is, in the entire world, if you take public perception of the favorability ratings to the United Nations, Korea is at the highest.
Fantastic.
And in large part because it's Secretary General Ban.
Sure.
But even before Secretary General Ban, there is a strong sense of gratitude by Koreans to the United Nations, for its help in the establishment of Republic of Korea, and in, as you may know, the only place in the world where you have a UN cemetery is in Korea.
Right,
so
yeah,
there is a great deal of connection between Korea and the United Nations, and Secretary General Ban, of course, is very fond of saying that he loves the United Nations, not just because, you know, he's the Secretary General of it, but because he had seen what UN has done for Korea and what it can do to other countries, you know, that are in a similar situation.
Yes.
Okay. So the desire of the young people in Korea to want to work for the United Nations is highly, you know, welcome. The UN needs, you know, people who are driven by what the UN can do to solve the problems of the people that need it most. And the UN, large as it is not, it doesn't have too many Koreans in it. So there are opportunities for
Good
Koreans to join. But my point is, it is not a place that you want to think about as soon as you finish school or finish college, you know, because, you know, in a world of 7 billion plus, the people that are working in the United Nations is a very small number.
Right.
And it is a competition that attracts the best and the brightest all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Koreans that aspire to be part of the United Nations need to think about what kind of expertise they bring to the table, and what kind of experience they have in working on similar fields, and then they need to compete with the rest. Just because you are low in number doesn't automatically guarantee that you get selected, you know, for the job.
Sure.
You need to compete with the best and the bright.
Well, it is something I think that people in Korea, maybe not always in a positive way, are very used to, however, and that is competition. Good advice, though, Doctor. Get some experience to try to set themselves apart. It has been a pleasure talking to you this morning. We thank you for your time, Dr. Ramakrishna, and we'd like to ask you if there's a song we could play for you to go out on today.
Wonderful, yes. Well, I like lots of songs, but I want to tell you right off the bat, I listen to songs more for the beat and what they do to me than the actual words. There are times when my daughter is scandalized by the kind of music that I listen to. But the song that I think, given the how cold it is outside, is probably by the American Authors group. It's called The Best Day of My Life.
Well, thank you for that request. We'll be happy to play that for you. And again, thank you for sharing your time with us here on TBS EFM's Inside Out.
It's a pleasure to be here with you, Walter, and thank you for the interview and, of course, for acknowledging the role that the UN Economic and Social Commission of Asia and the Pacific plays in the region.
It's been our pleasure, and here we are going out today on the American Authors singing Best Day of My Life.